oil industry is arguably the most profitable industry in the world, and it has combined earnings, at least of the seven top companies operating in the U.S., ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Valero, and Marathon, that totaled over $133 billion last year. That's more than the gross domestic product of New Zealand, Egypt, or Peru. Antonia Juhas takes a hard look at big oil in her latest book called The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. It's published by William Morrow, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Antonia Juhas to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And you make your feelings about the oil industry clear with your title and subtitle. Do we really have to stop big oil?
I believe that we do for a number of reasons. Paramount, particularly at this time, is because of the power that the profits of the companies give over the functioning or malfunctioning of our democracy. We're in the midst of a pretty key presidential debate and pretty key elections, looking at an economy that's in crisis, at least two wars, depending on how you calculate potentially what's going on with Pakistan, a climate crisis, all of these intimately linked with the oil industry. And we are needing to make key decisions over the fate of this industry and these resources, and are, I believe, unable to do so in a truly democratic fashion because of the power of the industry.
Which company is the largest in the U.S. in terms of earnings?
ExxonMobil, the largest corporation on the planet in terms of profits.
So it's the biggest in the world as well?
Biggest in the world, yeah.
And how much does it make annually?
Last year, ExxonMobil made over $40 billion in profits.
That's just profits.
Just profit. So in 2003, ExxonMobil made the highest profits of any corporation in world history ever, adjusted for inflation, period, then topped it in every year since and is continuing to increase its profits.
And you say only a fraction of those profits are passed on to the consumer.
Well, yes, in the way that we would like them to be. What I would like to see is rather than ExxonMobil hold on to its profits, and essentially this isn't just a problem in terms of what happens with profits with Exxon. I mean, we are currently living at a state in the U.S. economy in one of the largest divergences of wealth versus the poor. We've got a lot of wealth being captured at the top. Exxon is definitely one case in point and probably the most important because it's the most wealth that's being captured at the top and absolutely not in any way trickling down through society.
So if they have so much money, why don't they give consumers a break at the pump? Gas prices are higher than they have been, although I understand they are coming down a little bit, and we'll talk about that in a moment.
Yeah, oil prices just gone through a pretty big drop after the largest one-day price increase in crude oil futures history 1 week ago. Now we have an enormous drop. This is the nature of volatile prices.
Down to $90 a barrel today, and some are predicting that it'll drop to $50 a barrel by the end of next year. I remember a couple of months ago where people were saying, well, it's around $100 a barrel. Just get used to it. It's going to be that way from now until the end of time.
This is a market that is not functioning on the fundamentals of demand and supply. We are not experiencing shifts in price based on how much we're physically demanding of the price and how much is physically, of the product and how much is physically available of the product. The price is being manipulated by the companies, by the speculators, and that's not just crude. That's also gasoline.
So supply and demand is not a real factor here, but there are obviously other factors. The crisis in Wall Street has probably had a real impact on oil and gas prices because they assume that demand will be down.
Well, it's the fragility and the volatility of a market that's not being regulated. So I think that the relationship between what's happening on Wall Street and what's happening with oil, the most fundamental relationship is that it is deregulation, just as with the subprime mortgage crisis, that is at the heart of what I would call the crude oil price crisis, which is massive, massive deregulation that has facilitated, I think, most importantly and singularly, a word that people resonate with people is Enron. Enron energy traders moving in to work for big oil, moving in to work for banks, moving into hedge funds, doing what they did with electricity markets, now with crude energy, crude oil markets.
You said that the companies manipulate the prices. Did they do this in collusion with each other?
Well, there's two separate issues. So we've got gasoline prices and we've got crude oil prices. So if we're looking at gasoline prices, the two biggest concerns, I would say, are the vertical integration of the companies, concentration of the companies, and yes, collusion. So we've got only a handful of companies controlling refineries, controlling the pumps. Remember when there used to be lots of independent gas stations out there, lots of competition? Those have essentially been wiped away. And yes, I believe there's also collusion on price.
Well, aren't there laws in this country against collusion?
Laws. I remember something about laws. Yeah. We used to have all kinds of laws on the books. We still do. Most of them haven't been being enforced and haven't been being enforced appropriately.
Well, how do we wind up with the prices that we see at different gas stations? They have different prices. Are the individual gas stations setting their own prices?
No, and I think critically for consumers to understand, very rarely does the gas station owner have really anything to do with either profiting from the change in the price of gasoline and certainly not in setting it. It is the oil companies, and really we're looking at just a handful of the majors that even if you see different names on the gas pump, so you might see Shamrock and Ultramar and a bunch of different names. Well, that's all Valero. You might see Amoco and Arco, but that's still BP. We only have a handful of companies that own the vast majority of the gas stations and the gas and the refineries, and they are setting the price and they are capturing the profit.
So they tell this gas station owner, you're going to charge $3.78, and they tell the next one down the road you're going to charge $3.89?
Yeah, they're not allowed to actually tell them or to dictate the price, so they suggest prices to the gas stations. And they also control the prices through essentially putting a vise on the seller of the gasoline so that the seller of the gasoline only gets a set margin, a few pennies on the gallon, that doesn't change depending on the price at the pump.
How much does the futures market drive oil prices up or down?
It's the primary determinant of the price of oil at this point.
And so I think if I'm buying stuff now, it's going to determine what oil is going to cost at the pump 6 months down the line?
Well, more that the value that is set for the price of every gallon of oil is being determined by the actions of energy futures traders. So they are and remember who these guys are, and they're mostly guys. Are there people who are working for the banks, working for the oil companies, working at hedge funds? And they are, because they are doing so many trades, they are now setting the price. It's not OPEC. The oil companies have a far more role in setting the price of oil than they're traditionally given credit for. But even they are secondary to the traders.
So it's not the companies, the countries where the oil is being pumped. They play some role, but they play the least important role. What about the strength of the dollar? How does that affect the price of oil? When the dollar's weak, does the price of oil go up?
Yes, yeah, certainly the decline in the value of the dollar has definitely facilitated a rise in the price of crude. But the rising price of crude began in 2000, and it began at the moment when oil was deregulated. And it has intensified as we have shifted to deregulated exchanges.
We're saying that word deregulation again.
That deregulation word again, that's right.
Antonia Juhasz, J-U-H-A-S-Z, her latest book, The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry, What We Must Do to Stop It, is published by William Morrow. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say that every major candidate in this election has received money from big oil. Which companies were the biggest givers? Should I assume it's the ones that also make the most money?
Yeah, the biggest companies are the biggest givers. But also there are companies that we're less familiar with, the privately held U.S. companies like Koch Industries, for example. There are some private companies that give an awful lot of money that we pay less attention to. But really, it's the industry as a whole that we want to look at and how they give and who they give to. And the industry as a whole has given 75% of its money this year, the oil and gas industry, to the Republicans. That's what they usually do. $1.6 million so far to McCain-Palin versus less than $400,000 to Obama-Biden. Definitely big oil, the Republicans are the party of big oil and vice versa.
Well, both the president and vice president worked in the energy industry. But are they giving that money because of ideological reasons? Most of these oil companies just believe in the ideas of the Republican Party? Or is it because they feel that the Republican Party is more likely to promote the sort of legislation that they're interested in? When John McCain says, drill, baby, drill, uh-huh. Is he saying something that makes ExxonMobil happy?
Curls Exxon's toes. I actually think that this is also ideology. I think that it is an ideology to believe that the way to solve our problems is to drill, baby, drill, even with very, very clear evidence that, for example, drilling offshore at depths of greater than 500 feet, which is where we're moving, and 5,000 feet is really where we're moving, but anywhere off of more than 500 feet, releases methane. That's a greenhouse gas causing a toxin that is 20 times more potent than CO2 in causing climate change. So we are choosing to move into production methods, shale, tar sands, offshore, that is even more environmentally destructive, more climate chaos causing than the current models. And to me, that's an ideology, a belief that that's the path to the future that is possible and will lead to something better.
But Antonia, haven't I been seeing ads in the New York Times from oil companies that suggest that they are very committed to green?
Oh, you've been seeing these ads everywhere, as have I. A lot of money spent on trying to convince us that if you fill up your tank with Chevron, there's going to be daisies that are going to flow from behind your tailpipe. This is a way to try and convince us that, as most people in the public understand, we are moving into climate chaos, or we're in climate chaos. We have to do something. We need to embrace alternatives. So the oil industry wants us to believe that they are leading the way, and this is absolute 100% propaganda. When I looked into the spending of each of the major oil companies, and believe me, this wasn't easy to find, I identified through very generous estimates on my part, I would say, that absolutely the highest expenditure of any of the major oil companies on clean alternatives was BP at 4% of its total expenditures. Most of the others were far, far lower. This means that not only are they basically not spending money on alternatives, but instead they're embracing these much dirtier forms of production that are even more disastrous to our climate.
Well, how much are they investing in exploration for new oil sites when there were suggestions in Congress that we open up new places? The Democrats said, well, you should be encouraged to drill in the areas that you already have leases for. And that didn't seem to please everyone. The big call now is for more offshore drilling in places that have been banned so far, and also in Anwar in Alaska. Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I think the oil companies are drilling just plenty. I don't need them to do any more drilling.
But are they plowing a lot of their money back into trying to find more oil?
They are spending plenty of money on exploration and production, and I actually just don't buy the argument that they're not spending enough. The truth is, there isn't that much more oil out there. And to get to the oil that's left, you're going to have to go into countries where they own the oil and don't want us to have it through things like invasions and occupations, or you're going to have to go into regions where we've decided we really don't want anyone to drill there. We don't want you to drill offshore. We don't want you to drill in the Midwest. We don't want you to go after the tar sands. So what the companies are having to do really is spend a lot of money on exploration and production, which they do, and then spend a lot of money as well on lobbying to get us to change our laws to let them drill in places that we've already decided it's not appropriate or environmentally or politically or socially tenable for them to go.
But there are also some people who claim that there isn't all that much oil in these places. So why put all that money into trying to find oil that's going to be dried up in 10 years?
Because the oil companies intend to remain oil companies. And while it is possible, because these are very volatile markets, that yes, the price of oil could potentially drop to $50, I would be surprised. Really, the trend is going to be up and up and up and up, because we are it's inevitable that we're going to hit a place where demand does, in fact, exceed supply. And we are going to hit a place where the oil is just going to have to keep valuing up. And for the oil companies, even if there's only a little bit of oil, if it's selling at $500 a barrel, that's the stuff you're going to want to keep working on.
Well, why then did oil prices go down even before this economic crisis really hit big?
Because we've got an incredibly non-transparent, volatile market. The one-day price increase, just really quickly, we had one day last week where the price went up $25 at one point in one day. That's now been attributed to the actions of a single trader. We had one person who was able to completely manipulate the market such that entire economies have been roiled and rolled in response.
Does he get punished for that?
Well, apparently the Commodity Futures Trading Commission is investigating. You know, don't hold your breath. This is also a very politicized agency. We're starting to see massive cracks in the system. So, for example, Christopher Cox, who's the head of the Security and Exchange Commission, lifelong devotee of deregulation, saying, I simply have to admit that self-regulation by corporations just doesn't work. That's going to have to start infiltrating into these other markets as well, and hopefully we'll get our regulatory agencies to start regulating.
Are we starting to see a change among the Republicans? Because even before Christopher Cox admitted to that, he was criticized by John McCain for not really being in control of the situation.
Well, are we seeing a change in the Republicans? We are seeing a lot of populist language that suddenly emerged full force into our political dialogue. Governor Palin in the last debate, you know, could have been wearing the gosh darn populist support hat if she wasn't wearing the drill baby drill hat. But that language isn't supported in policy. So the policies that are being advocated are still, unless you're talking about the nationalizations of Fannie and Freddie Mac, are still basically deregulatory policies. And we've got to see an actual change in policy for me to believe that the party is changing its outlook.
My guest is Antonia Juhasz, J-U-H-A-S-Z. Her latest book, The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, published by William Morrow. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Antonia Juhasz. Her book, The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, is published by William Morrow. You suggest that oil companies spend even more money on lobbying for legislation. How much are we talking about?
We're talking about millions and millions of dollars. In fact, ExxonMobil spent 14 times more money lobbying than it does on federal campaigns. Most of the oil companies spend this percentage larger than they spend on federal campaigns. The reason is that essentially spending on federal campaigns is reported on, and it's limited, and it's something that people pay attention to. And no candidate really wants to wear the lapel pin of being in big oil's pocket. There's only a few places where that is a winning strategy for candidates. So what the oil industry does, and what most industries do, is instead, when they want to influence candidates, is really spend the big money on lobbying, on influencing the day-to-day decision-making of our elected officials.
Can you give us an example of a law that was passed or modified due to oil industry pressure?
Well, I can give you examples of laws that were stopped. So, for example, for the past year, there's been very strong attempts to try and eliminate the $16 billion in tax subsidies that the Bush administration has given to the oil and gas industry. Each of these efforts has died. There have been a number of analyses in trying to look at why have the efforts died. And basically, the bottom line has been those who have voted against the measures have received four times more money from the oil and gas industry than those who voted for the
measures. Well, the Democrats right now enjoy a majority in both houses of Congress, so that means that there are Democrats who are also getting that money.
Most certainly. Most certainly. Essentially, the oil industry does give by party and ideology, as we discussed earlier, but it also gives by where the oil is, who sits on key committees, where their refineries are. And so you do see in states like my own, Senator Feinstein, fair recipient of oil industry money. You see Democrats in Alaska, Democrats in Texas. There are a few who get money from the oil industry. And at the end of the day, the industry is just, you know, trying to get access.
Now, I would guess that if you asked Americans what drives up the prices, they will come up with OPEC as one of the reasons, mm-hmm. because it had such an important effect on oil prices in the past. How much influence do they have on the price of oil these days?
Not nearly as much as they used to, and that's been evidenced very clearly of late when Saudi Arabia has actually been trying to follow the Bush administration's demands to increase production. Saudi Arabia has increased production, and in response to Saudi Arabia's increases in production, the price of oil just keeps rising. OPEC does have 40% of the world's oil. It certainly has an influence.
Do we really know how much oil they have? Do they report their reserves accurately?
Right. Well, really nobody knows how much oil anybody has, but based on what they tell us, and it seems fair to assume whether what they're telling us is high or low, everybody's fudging the numbers. So when Exxon tells us that it has 11 billion in reserves, or BP tells us that it has 10 billion in reserves, we're only as sure of that as we are when Saudi Arabia tells us how large its reserves are, and everyone's trying to bloat their numbers. So within the context of everybody bloating their numbers and nobody knowing for sure, I think it's safe to assume that OPEC has only 40%. But really, there was a concerted effort by people such as Henry Kissinger and others within the United States, and particularly among the oil industry, after the 70s oil crises, to intentionally break OPEC's price-setting ability. And that was done through three mechanisms. One was expanding drilling outside of the OPEC nations. Two was conservation, which worked for a time. And then three was deregulating the price of oil and getting it onto futures trades.
How much does a history of oil affect the way a country thinks about oil? I'm thinking about Sweden that says that it wants to move away from oil completely within a couple of years. Their neighbor, Norway, has had oil. I suspect that the Norwegians, do not have the same attitude as the Swedes.
If you've got oil, you think it's a good resource.
And we really were the pioneer in oil exploration. I think it was Pennsylvania and then Texas and California. And yes. I still remember the days when you saw those little oil things going up and down when you visited much of Los Angeles.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All gone now.
Well, I mean, you know, I would say in terms of how a country's history affects its relationship to oil, what's probably most important for Americans to understand is the history of U.S. oil companies operating in the Middle East, particularly right now with our relationship with Iran, our relationship with Iraq, our relationship with Saudi Arabia, all across the Middle East. These are nations that their entire economies, their political development, this is also true for Africa, this is also true for South America, Central America, the entire political structure of these countries were controlled by the U.S. and in some cases British and French oil companies that owned and controlled and dictated the price of oil in their countries until very concerted independence movements wrenched back ownership and control of that oil.
And they hate the British even more than they hate the United States in most of those
countries.
Some
hate the British. Yeah, well, for other colonial reasons as well,
Iran,
of course.
In Iran, I've heard they say it's blame the British whenever anything goes wrong.
And the Americans, because, of course, you know, the CIA was part of the very organized movement to unseat the
Mossadegh.
Democratic leader of Mossadegh, and when there is talk by the Bush administration, for example, of the United States bringing, you know, democracy to Iran through a military invasion, this is the historical context in which Iranians see this, which is that the United States has pursued political and economic objectives using its military that are all based in oil in the region and is doing so again.
What does a country like Israel do? After all, most of the oil-producing nations are, at least on paper, enemies of Israel.
How does that affect the U.S. relationship to the region?
What does Israel do about fueling its automobiles?
Well, Israel has some. Well, I don't know. How does Israel get its oil? I'm not positive how Israel gets its oil.
For a little while, they got some oil from oil wells that they had when they were occupying the Sinai, but they gave those back to Egypt.
I'm not sure how Israel gets its oil. It's a very interesting question.
And I don't think that they're doing alternative energy.
No, I don't think so. But it's not a lot of people and it's not a lot of territory, so maybe they don't need very much oil.
Well, what about some of the other oil sources that we hear about? You mentioned the Canadian tar sands and mm-hmm. Midwestern shale.
Yeah, this is what the oil industry, when the oil industry gives us figures on how much money they're spending on quote-unquote alternative energy to make it sound like they're spending a lot, they include in this category their tar sand production and their shale production. Now, those are, just like the name implies, the tar sands are in Alberta, Canada, and it is tar. It's tar that if you...
Tar is oil, isn't it? It's just solidified oil?
Yeah, but we're talking about an incredibly dense, sandy, packed tar that if you dig out enormous quantities of it, add an enormous amount of water, heat it to a very high degree, you can get a tiny, tiny bit of bitumine out of it and actually get some crude. And essentially, this is a process that is intensely energy intensive, climate destroying, very expensive, and happening in native land in Canada, and very destructive environmentally. But that's just the production. So we have all of the major oil companies that are operating in Alberta and expanding their tar sand production. They then need to bring that dirty, heavy crude here to then refine it into gasoline. The refining process is also significantly more polluting than is traditional refining.
Well, wasn't there a law passed requiring refineries to clean up their acts?
Yeah, this is we'll go down in history and one of the worst implemented laws probably in the history of the United States. So in an attempt to clean up our nation's refineries, which were causing massive pollutants and contributing to acid rain, in an attempt to clean our air, we passed the Clean Air Act. One of the things the Clean Air Act did was require that all new refineries built in the United States use the cleanest, most high-end technology, which was readily available at the time. But existing refineries could be grandfathered in. The companies could keep their old refineries and just when they put in a sizable change to the refinery, add the new technology. So as a result, not a single new refinery has been built in the United States since 1976. The refineries that we have are old, they are decrepit, they are polluting, and they are prone to devastating explosions.
So the law, in effect, encouraged the oil refinery or the oil companies to not build more refineries.
It was supposed to encourage them to be better public
citizens.
To build
cleaner ones.
Instead, what it did, yes, was keep them entrenched in their dirty old refineries. And what this says to me is that at this point, if Chevron, if Exxon, if Conoco wants to prove to you and I that these are clean companies that we should want to support, forget those piddling investments in solar and wind, and instead make your refineries the safest, cleanest, most glittering examples of how well a company can operate, and make them safe for their communities, safe for those who work at them and around them. And that would be the best example of how the oil companies could be spending their money, in my opinion.
My guest is Antonia Juhas, who is a fellow with Oil Change International and the Institute for Policy Studies. She's written for most of the leading publications, the New York Times, International Herald Tribune, Los Angeles Times, Petroleum Review Magazine, which I read all the time, also alternet.org. And her latest book is called The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry, What We Must Do to Stop It, published by William Morrow. Our listeners are always out there with information, and it turns out a caller says that Israel plans to eliminate all oil-driven cars by 2011.
Excellent.
The United States, I just saw 60 Minutes yesterday, and we are so far away from coming up with an alternative that it's kind of shocking. And the head of General Motors is still denying that there's such a thing as global warming. I don't know if you saw that.
I did not see that. Even Governor Palin admits that there is such a thing as global warming.
Well, she kind of said that most of it isn't man-made, but that's another matter. Is there some kind of a relationship, a working relationship between the oil companies and the automakers?
Yeah, there has been for a significantly long period of time. But that relationship has been strained recently. With the price of oil going up, it's actually become this moment in time where it's very much helped the oil industry and very much hurt the auto industry. Now, people like myself and all of the many wonderful activist groups that exist in this country have spent decades saying to the auto industry, you need to adapt. You need to use more energy efficient, non-fuel based cars. And that's how you're going to move into the future.
Because they're being penny wise and pound foolish.
They're being very penny wise and pound foolish. And they're now reaping the extreme losses. Instead of building fuel efficient cars, instead of building electric cars, they built the Hummer, and now they're all going out of business. And now it's really time, to start paying attention. It may be too late for some of the old giants.
Now, Joseph Stiglitz has pointed out that while we're subsidizing the government in Iraq, Iraq is socking away billions of dollars in oil revenues.
Yeah, I find this a difficult criticism, and it's one that both Obama and Biden make that makes me very unsettled. The Bush administration went into Iraq, invaded Iraq, fired 120,000 of all of Iraq's bureaucrats because those were the people who were going to stand in the way of the next step, which was the implementation of completely new economic and political laws in an attempt to restructure Iraq so that, among other things, U.S. oil companies could come in and take ownership of Iraqi oil.
Well, this is your theory. They deny that.
They don't deny the firing of 120,000 bureaucrats. They don't deny the attempt to remake the economic and political laws. And no one denies the fact that the United States helped draft a law, both oil companies and the Bush administration, to transform Iraq from a nationalized to a privatized oil system.
This is the National Oil Law?
Yeah, this is the National Oil Law. There's nothing controversial in those statements. The country was, of course, invaded. The country is, of course, occupied. The country is reaping the benefits of a very high price for oil. But to say that it's and I'm sure that there is corruption within the Iraqi government, and I would put that in parts of the Iraqi government. On the other hand, to say that the Iraqis are intentionally filtering away money, hiding it somewhere, as opposed to,
I don't think he's saying that. I think he said it's U.S. policy to encourage this for whatever reason, at the same time that we are subsidizing the building of roads and not asking the Iraqis to use that oil money to do these things when that's what Paul Wolfowitz said at the start was going to happen.
Iraqis are spending a tremendous amount of money and have been spending money on reconstruction. My problem with this analysis is simply where is the blame being placed? I think that the blame rests with the policies put in place by the Bush administration, not at this stage with the Iraqis.
In another thing, looking to the future, one report says that even if every car in the United States was made into a hybrid, we would still run out of oil in about 15 years. Now, we've been hearing that we're going to run out of oil within 15 years now for the last 50 years or so.
Well, There have been very good predictions of things like peak oil hitting the United States in 1970, which in fact it did, and we've been on the decline ever since. It's difficult to predict because it's difficult to get exact amounts of how much oil is out there. It's difficult to predict consumption. It's difficult to predict pricing. But what we do know for certain, without any doubt, is that oil is a finite, non-renewable natural resource, and that consumption has been catapulting, and that we are consuming 4 barrels of oil for every 1 new barrel that we find.
We have just a half a minute left, but you advocate a separation of oil and state. What would that mean?
Yeah, this is a call essentially based on the very successful campaigns against the tobacco industry in the 90s that essentially said to candidates, if you want to be elected, you need to renounce tobacco industry money. We say this is what we need to do for the oil industry, renounce all oil industry money so that we can move forward.
Antonia Juhasz, J-U-H-A-S-Z, will be at the Puffin Room tonight at 6:30. That's at 435 Broome Street. She'll be giving a talk and signing books. And the book is the tyranny of oil, the world's most powerful industry, and what we must do to stop it. It is published by William Morrow, and it has been a great pleasure to talk to you about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm sure that there are some people out there driving cars who are feeling very guilty at this very moment. What do you think?
Get out of your car and walk. No.
Thanks again. On tomorrow's show, how Abraham Lincoln became a great commander-in-chief despite his lack of military experience. Also, Alice Waters and Tara Parker Pope with tips for parents who want to feed their kids healthy foods that appeal to even the most picky eaters. Sarah Vowell talks about America's Puritan roots. Plus, our latest political projections is all about biopics like JFK and Young Mr. Lincoln and whether they're rooted in any sense of reality. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Julia Corcoran, Carolyn Silvera, and Leslie Dickstein. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening.